Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Combox Live, where the game lives on, it never dies, it is immortal. I'm Behram Kazi, who you can find at DefMango on Twitter, and with me is my good mate, Sir Robert Henry Barron. First of his name, taker of catches and slagger offer of the English cricket team and board. And we are here in the wake of Brendan McCullum's sacking as England's red ball head coach. So Rob Stokesy, Ben Stokes, he retired from international cricket about a fortnight ago. And now Baz McCullum has been sacked. And emphasis on the word sacked, he hasn't stepped down by any means, as the ECB is suggesting, because in his own words, he is gutted but respects the decision. So it is a sacking. Take it away.
Yeah, I mean, Stokes wasn't going to go down without causing some havoc on the way out, which is what he did in the test. And then it appears a bit of shrapnel finally got rid of McCullum. Justifiable decision. Lots of the decisions they've made are unjustifiable, but he said himself, basically, I can't argue with it. He wasn't going to quit. He's getting paid absolutely. If you ever, ladies and gentlemen, get paid absolutely loads of money for half-assing a job and not doing anything, take the money, right? So we cannot blame the human of McCullum for being allowed to go on holiday and get paid loads of money. And if you can convince your bosses that dreadful results are fine, please carry on and get your £1 million a year, right? Well done to him. But he wasn't the right man for the job, as was proven by the results, which is ultimately what you're meant to be judged on. Off you go. I think white ball looks a better fit for him anyway. And if you're you know, used to taking 6 month holidays during your work, probably best that you don't do all the jobs, right? Have the one that gives you some time off. So when they are playing tests, he can now, with impunity, go and watch horse racing or whatever it is that he does.
You know, I was quite shocked, actually. I thought that Rob Key might get the sack and McCullum might keep his job, but the opposite has happened. And did you foresee this? Could you see Baz getting sacked? Because it's come as a bit of a surprise to me.
Nothing is a surprise with this lot. I mean, the sensible thing would be the surprise. So when the Ashes happened and, you know, what I don't like is when you get stuff happen is when commentators or people that are asked for their opinions don't remember all the stuff that they used to say and they just react to what's happening now and like, I told you so. We're in a position here, Behram, where you and I have recorded so much stuff about the England cricket team. Go back and listen to what we said all the way along, right? I'm not changing my mind here. They should have got rid of all of them after the Ashes, you know, because they said they bet the farm on the Ashes and they lost heavily. Mm. And so for the Richard Gould, who got the easiest of throwdown dolly interviews from Nick Knight yesterday, I said in our group that I was half expecting Nick Knight to, you know, jump on his lap and lay down to get his belly rubbed while he was interviewing him. Nick Knight asked him questions, but he wasn't bothered that Gould wasn't answering them. You know, he's got, what do you think? Has Key got anything to do with McCullum's departure? Well, for breakfast this morning, I had bacon and eggs. Yeah, but then you answer the question, right? Anyway, never mind about that. Richard Gould said McCullum could evolve and learn from the mistakes in Australia and that getting rid of him, this is a quote, would have been the easy option. The bad option is letting him then continue in the job. And as soon as one result goes against you, you sack him because then you've wasted 6 months or longer. So they wasted 6 months and they let him have the job for a bit more, realised that they were still shit and got rid. Okay, how the hell does Rob Key keep his job in all of this? And Gould, how does he keep his job? Because nobody is policing the police, right? So all of this stuff that Gould was saying, he said the timing is right to get rid of him now. The timing was right 7 months ago. That's when the timing was right. And we could have had 7 months of the new guy or girl or team or whatever starting to get put together. Instead, they pissed away another series. Part of that was the Ben Stokes show. Part of that was, we're not going to pick any of our players because they're all drunk, whatever. They mucked it up again. Now we're in the limbo thing. They'll probably go, wouldn't surprise me if it's interim coach type situation till the end of the summer if they can't get who they want. Who knows what's going to happen now? But we said at the time they should have got rid. They didn't get rid. They've got rid of one of the people. One of the other people has gone. But Gould, the man in charge, and Rob Key, the whatever he's called, director of cricket, are still in situ having done a rubbish job.
Yeah, No, there's no doubt about that. And we've mentioned quite a few times that the buck just doesn't fall on Stokesy and Baz. It's the entire system and all the administrators who have enabled this disaster class. But I actually want to revisit the start of Baz Ball, you know, because we should be complete and fair to the Stokes-McCullum partnership and Baz Ball as a whole. And prior to Stokes and McCullum, you know, taking over the reins of English cricket, we saw that England just could not buy a test match win. They had won a solitary test in their last 17 attempts prior to Baz Ball. And that obviously did not make for good reading. And Baz Ball brought instant results. They picked those sort of teams and understood that they're probably better off attacking. Now, there is some merit to that school of thought. And I think as a tactic, it still works. But perhaps they overdid it. And the biggest takeaway is that Baz Ball has left English cricket in absolute tatters. They're not much better off from where they were at when they had lost, you know, all those test matches and won just one out of 17. And Varun loves this stat, but in that 2021 calendar year, England's third highest run scorer was extras, right? Sundries. And I'm not sure if, you know, they've gained anything in these 4 years apart from the fact that, I don't know, maybe they should be a bit more smart with respect to their on-field decision-making, or have they even learnt that?
No. So when it started, I was really pleased initially because picking players that were naturally more aggressive or less defensive, players that were trying to win matches rather than trying not to lose them, completely with that, right? Let's have this. Let's not forget that the white ball stuff was in turmoil for decades before the revolution there. Farbray started it, I think. But the revolution started against New Zealand, didn't it? It's right, let's go and try and score loads of runs and see how that works. Then they added more tactics to it, you know, the middle order enforcing, getting wickets in the middle overs, timing things so they really are banging all the way down, all that kind of thing. But they thought about it, that white ball team. And when the World Cup at home came along, they were completely ready to win it. You know, they managed to add Jofra Archer, it helped, but they were ready to win it and they won it really well. And what this lot did is they came up with a tactic that was very, very good. And initially, it caught some people by surprise. The best one early was the New Zealand Bairstow one when they were really... I was there. I was at that game. It was great. They were really struggling and they chased 350 overs, which is unheard of in Test match cricket. And Bairstow, and it was Jamie Overton, wasn't it? Belting it everywhere for a lovely afternoon, having been in big trouble before that. Wonderful. They did it twice in that series, didn't they, against New Zealand? They chased 350 overs, and then I've written down here they've chased 360 and then chased 296 in 54. That was Root and Bairstow. So in successive test matches, they absolutely bossed it by whacking it in favourable conditions. When the sun was shining, they came out and whacked it and turned games on its head, and we were like, wow, this is great, absolutely brilliant. But they never progressed with the tactic. They never used it as a tactic then. They used it as the mast to pin all their colours to and totally forgot how to play cricket. So they're like, what we do now, because it worked, is we're going to whack it, whack it, whack it. And occasionally then you get the ridiculous road. Moultan, was it?
Yep.
You get the...
Wait, no.
They got six.
That was the second series in which they lost. The first test was Moultan.
Sorry, the 823 for seven was Moultan, yeah. And the 600
you're,
in a day...
You're thinking about Rawalpindi. That was 500 in a day.
Rawalpindi road. 500 in, what was that, 75 overs, and they got 657 in 100 overs in the innings or something. You think, and then declared and then bowled them out. You're like, where has this been? Where has this England team been that can go to the mega road and somehow get a result out of it by scoring at 6.5 and over for a whole innings and getting 650. That's the only way you can win on them mega roads is by giving yourself enough time to then declare and then bowl them out. Awesome, right? And then we go back to Pakistan and get the super mega road in Moultan. And you go, all right, okay, Brooke gets a triple. And then Pakistan were like, well, actually, maybe roads aren't the way to go. Let's let the ball spin a bit. And England got stuffed in two tests and lost the series, right? That kind of exposed... You can't just have one tactic and go out and try and whack it all the time. So the bit that you said there, Behram, about are they in a better place now than when they started? No, because they've gone fully stupid. They've lost a really good all-rounder in Ben Stokes. You know, how long he had left at playing well, I don't know. But they've lost a really good all-rounder, so the balance has gone now. They've lost the coach. who started with the tactic, they look like they don't really know how to play Test cricket, if that series that we've just had is anything to go by.
And
so they started off. This happens with football teams, though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The new manager bounce. Mm. So the team does shit, get new manager, play really well for a bit, then revert to being shit again. And this happens loads, doesn't it, in other sports?
Yeah. I mean, Muqtada Hameed over here is saying that they were tactically rigid, and I agree. Because, look, I'm not saying that Bazball didn't change cricket. It definitely did. We saw scoring rates go up for a lot of teams. I know Pakistan weren't scoring as quickly as they do or did after Bazball. They were going at under 3 runs and over, and they bumped that up to near to 4 runs and over. And then we saw Sri Lanka also bump up their scoring rates. And we saw a bit of a trend globally. No one was batting as quickly as England. But the point is that, sure, you came up with a new method, but there's got to be some extra steps to that method, right? Like, for them, it was just attack, 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 and aggressive batting. You know, it works in phases. There are times where you have to weather the storm, and England just seemed to want to die on that hill, that no, this is the way we play and we're going to continue to play that way regardless of the conditions. I think that might be one of the biggest Achilles heels for this entire tenure, and that cost them dearly. There were so many tests where you felt that England had the advantage and they squandered it because they were just hell-bent on playing that certain way.
Yeah, and that started the tactical ineptitude New Zealand away. Because they basically beat everybody. Hmm. They beat New Zealand at home 3-0 at the start. Then they played the ridiculous last test of the series that India were murdering England in a year and a half later or whatever it was. The one-off test, and England bossed that test. That was another mad chase. 378 chased in 75 overs or something. That was Bairstow again.
Yeah.
So they had Bairstow on fire. Then they beat South Africa at home. Then they beat Pakistan away. And we're like, wow, this is awesome, right? We're winning all the time. We're beating good teams. Home, and we're duffing up Pakistan 3-0 away. Maybe we're onto something here. Then we play New Zealand away in a 2-test match series. And in the first test, we had a really, really good team performance and beat New Zealand away, which isn't easy. Ask India, you know, beat New Zealand nice and easy. Well done, everyone. If you're 1-0 up in a 2-match series, the thing you don't do is give the other team a chance to win a test match that they don't deserve, that they haven't earned. So obviously England then get caught up with their own bravado. Root is 150 not out. They're 8 down. They declare, they enforce a follow-on, which they don't need to, and then lose by a run. Yep. And England's take home from that wasn't that a load of fun? Wasn't that brilliantly entertaining?
Yeah.
No, what it was, England, is yes, you manufactured a really entertaining game, but you manufactured a loss from a kind of unlosable position. So that is a test series that England pissed away with their overall goal of making the match more fun.
And
now,
that you could say was probably the first bump in the road, because like I mentioned, prior to Bazball and Stokes and McCullum being at the helm, they had won a solitary test out of 17. In their first 11 tests together, Stokes and McCullum had been victorious in 10. And they lost just that one test versus South Africa at home. It is really that New Zealand test that you talk about, you know, and it's the declaration that also needs to be spoken of over here, because England, you know, they got heaps of plaudits when they declared in Rawalpindi, dangled the carrot in front of Pakistan. Pakistan took the bait and they lost that test match on a surface where you really shouldn't be losing any sort of test, right? Ever. And then after that progressive declaration, we saw what happened in New Zealand, and then we also saw what happened at Edgbaston. You love to mention how in both those instances, England were 8 down with Root having been not out on 100+, but England declared anyway and they ended up losing those test matches. But the narrative that they kept pushing was that we're saving test cricket. This is highly entertaining. It's not about results. It's about what you put forward and how we're saving the format, this, that, the other. And that is the start of where it all starts to go wrong, isn't it?
Yeah, so that New Zealand one, they came out of that test match and they said, but wasn't it a great game? Yes, it was, right? England now in the football are playing a semi-final on Wednesday night against Argentina. Ask every football fan in England whether they would like to be part of the best game ever on Wednesday night and England lose 6-5, having just been really, really stupid, or they take a horrible grind win on penalties. Nobody's going to say, let's hope we have a great game and lose. We want to win, right? We want to get the goal is to get to the final of the World Cup, however that may happen. So this lot, pissed away a series against New Zealand that they were 1-0 up and miles ahead of the game because they wanted to do stupid stuff. They declared they gave them a sniff. New Zealand are not a team that you give a chance to. Look at the recent series at home. They took their chance and they won, albeit by one run. It could have easily gone either way. It could have been a bloody tie by the end of it. It was great entertainment, no question. But that's okay, because the team have done really, really well home and away since this new regime has taken over. And you can forgive them for an overzealous declaration and a slightly silly manufacturing of a result that didn't need to be manufactured. When you're 1-0 up with one to play, you don't need to do the manufacturing of the result. That's what the other team's meant to do. Anyway, let's forgive them that, because they may have got slightly caught up in their own, you know, they might have believed all their own hype. But they then said, we're doing all this. All of this preparation is for the big show, which is Australia coming to town, which they then did. And we shouldn't ignore it, really, but ignoring, for the sake of this great big long narrative, we battered Ireland in a one-off test. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone's forgotten that. No one really cares. It got a couple of players into form. It's basically the next test match where there's something on it is the very first test of the series. Root is 100 and something not out with a decent bat for company. And they declared in the first test of the Ashes, I've been angry about this many times, I'm not going to go on about it too much here, but ended up losing that test match by 2 wickets and drew the series. Had they not declared and scored another 50, which was there for the taking with Root 100 and whatever he was, 120 not out, they would have won that game. And with it, they would have won the series. So they pissed the series away. There was a rain draw that where we were battering them. You know, that can happen in cricket. But what they did is, because of their own daft tactics, you know, not knowing that the declaration that they did made them more likely to lose the game. That's the critical bit here, Bayram, is the declaration made them less likely to win.
Yep.
Right? It didn't eliminate the chance of a draw or anything. It was straight up, who's going to win this game, England or Australia? They declared. They made Australia more likely to win. Australia, a team very much like New Zealand, that if you give them a chance, they will go, thank you very much. We will take this chance and then we will use it to our advantage. England don't. They piss it away. So they drew that series. Then what happens? Off we go to India, right? So all of this new regime, wonderful stuff, we've done brilliantly, now feels a bit sour because we've drawn 2 series that we should have won, and one of them was an Ashes series, and we don't win many of them in recent history. So we should have beat New Zealand away and Australia at home. Instead, those 2 series were drawn, Bayram, so they messed it up. Then they go away to India, and bloody Tom Hartley gets a 7 for because he's tall, right? And he's got a high release point with his arm, and he got some runs as well. And you're like, okay, well, I mean, what is this team? How have they discovered this?
How many runs did they chase in that test win in Hyderabad, if I'm not wrong, the Ollie Pope test?
So he got a brilliant 196, I want to say.
Something like that.
Something around that. And that was a great knock. He was reverse sweeping all over the place as a properly intelligent tactic, funnily enough. You know, who'd have said that 30 years ago? And yeah, okay. Bumrah plays for that team and Jaiswal got a double in one of the tests, and India at home are a very, very tough team to beat. And we got span out to hell by Ashwin and Kuldeep in one of them. Losing 4-1 away to India, lots of teams have done that, right? That's okay. But the cracks now are beginning to widen because, you know, yes, beating South Africa at home is good, but their team was very much in transition. Drawing 2 series that they should have won, all right, the cracks are widening here, then going to play a proper team and getting absolutely murdered. And then they don't play again until Windies at home and Sri Lanka at home.
Yep.
With respect to the Windies, they were an utter shambles when they came over to us at that point, and we stuffed them. And it wasn't a series that where any of the results were in doubt, mainly because the West Indies were terrible. And we battered them 3-0, and I've forgotten the series already. I think Atkinson got some wickets.
Yep. Atkinson at Lord's debut test match. I was there. Jimmy's final test match.
That's right.
Yep. That one. And then in the Sri Lanka series that followed in that summer, they lost at the Oval, the Pathum Nisanka test match, right?
Yeah, okay. And that was a test where England mucked about again. And it was kind of like, but again, from an England supporter's point of view, I don't mind us taking the foot off the gas so much when you're 2-0 up with one to play. That's an okay test to not play your best. I don't mind that. England lost to a team that played well. Kamindu came of age, didn't he? Or just came, you know, cemented his place on the scene in that series. He was great. and Sri Lanka were well worth their win over the three matches, fair enough, all right? I don't really mind that. You can't just say, oh, England lost, they should always win. You're playing a sports match against a team of 11 people that are also trying. That's a fair enough result, 2-1 at home to Sri Lanka. That'll do. Job done. And then, obviously, you add Pakistan to England's carnage and it's going to be stupid. Mm. And then we got one of the all-time stupid innings of English cricket. Multan, that one was, at 823 for 7.
Yep.
I mean, what did Brooke get, 300 and whatever?
Yeah, you and I could have probably scored a half century on that track. It was that placid.
Yeah, maybe. It may be. But got the test match won again on a super mega road because they scored really fast. And again, great tactics. But then Pakistan went, I know what we'll do is we'll have pitches that aren't like this because England keep belting us on these pitches. And it's kind of, if you bat first and you're England on them, you might be in trouble. But if England are chasing, you also might be in trouble. What do we do? Our spinners are way better than England. Over to, it was Noman, wasn't it?
And Sajid. It was the partnership.
And Sajid, yeah. They were just too good for England. And again, losing away in the subcontinent against spinners, England normally do that. Lost 2-1, all right, fair enough. It appears we're just going through every series that they play. Then they play New Zealand next, is that right?
I don't know if there were tests on that tour, were they?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Yes,
They went to New Zealand again. They won
2-1.
2-1. Yeah. And they won the first two really well and handsomely. And then Santner played one of the test match of his life. He got loads of runs and loads of, I think he got 125 runs and 7 for 85 or something in the test match. Ludicrously good. And again, at this point, you're like, okay, those two away series, we lost 1-2-1 and it was spinning loads and we won 1-2-1 away in New Zealand. Cool, you know, all right. Not overachieving here at any point, England, are they? Mm. They're just kind of doing what they should do. Crucially, though, Bayram, something that you can't ignore from the results that are on the paper, the target when you're the coach of the England cricket team, I don't mind the entertainment stuff. You know, God knows England have been boring for some time, tactically at least, is you should try and win the competitions that you've entered. Mm. And the World Test Championship is definitely a competition that England entered. And they played as if they weren't interested in it even a little bit. They played as if they hated it and it was an insult that they'd been asked to take part in it and were almost sticking two fingers up to the organisers of it. You know, ask New Zealand and ask South Africa what it felt like to win that mace at Lords. Mm. Like, pretty good, wasn't it? Like, those occasions were good fun.
Plus, it's one thing to not acknowledge the World Test Championship at all, but I think Stokesy is on record at some point saying that he doesn't even understand how the points work. So it's not something exactly, they talk about in their dressing room. That's the idea that we got from his remarks. And I kind of want to talk about all of the dogmatic stuff that we have heard in the press over the years during this Bazball era. But before that, we will be taking a short break. You guys are watching Combox Live with Bayram and Rob Barron. Go nowhere. We will be back in about 22 seconds.
Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible now. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN.
Welcome back to Combox Live. You guys are with Bayram and Rob Barron, and we are currently, you know, kind of halfway through an autopsy of Bazball. And before the break, I mentioned all the dogmatic remarks in the press that we heard from England. I reckon it was the 2023 Ashes series where England ultimately drew the series 2-2, where at some point Ben Stokes was on record saying that those who have witnessed us play were lucky, right? We've also heard Ollie Pope saying at some point that they could chase 600 down someday. And Ollie Robinson, I think, once mentioned how there's never any talk about winning test matches. It's just about playing a certain way. And of course, then the over-indexing of the Ashes or fixation on the Ashes that we've seen from England. That might not be a baseball issue, actually. That might just be an English cricket issue where Baz McCullum himself said that this is the most important series and they retired Jimmy Anderson specifically for the Ashes. They got rid of the classic English seamer for the Ashes. They wouldn't pick the guys who would bowl good line and length and could, you know, bowl wobble seam. They went for faster, hit-the-deck sort of bowlers because they expected the wickets to be a certain way in Australia and they weren't a certain way. And, you know, it just felt like we continued to get the same sort of rubbish in those press conferences and media talks where there was no accountability, there was no ownership, there was no emphasis on winning test matches or caring about the World Test Championship at all. And, you know, once they had lost that Ashes series in Australia or were on course, you know, to lose it, there was also Jeetan Patel's remark saying that this is not an important series, which was a direct contradiction to what Baz McCullum had said. So the list goes on and on and on. I've probably forgotten a few instances as well. The moral Ashes, of course, Harry Brooks saying that it's a moral victory at the Oval, whatnot. It got a bit too much, didn't it?
Yeah. So they're liars and they're hypocrites and they didn't do what they said they were going to do. And then they're gaslighters as well, which is an awful thing to be, is when you're gaslighting your paying public. Because it's one thing to come out and say, well, we don't know what the rules are of the World Test Championship. So if they keep fining us loads and loads of points because we don't know how to bowl 80 overs in a day, never mind 90, then that's on everybody else. It's one thing to say that publicly, which they did. It's another thing to charge £175 to go and watch the team play for a day. That is the most in the world by a long way. £175, that is a shitload of money. You know, you're looking at a day at the cricket is £300 easy. That is loads of money. You know, you could stay in a mega nice hotel and get fed and watered for £300 for a weekend, really. Anyway, So they're gaslighting their own fans. Don't worry about this series. That doesn't matter. Everything's to do with the Ashes. And then a really, really good prelude to the Ashes in a test series is playing India at home. Mm. And India had a couple of their own issues. And it was a brilliantly fun series.
Yeah.
The bit that stands out in my head from that series is just Siraj's overall contribution. There was one point where Siraj got bowled, having played a forward defence off the middle of the bat. Mm-hmm. And that was... that was the winning wicket of one of the games.
That's the last game, isn't Kashmir. It? No. That's the second last game. India won the last.
Yeah. The last one was England throwing it in the bin.
Yeah.
And again, so just running through that series briefly, starts off with a barnstorming Baz ball mega chase of 370 odd in 80 overs. Right? You think if we're beating India like that, maybe we've got something here. Let's just see if we can use our brains for the rest of the series. And they get absolutely battered in the second one, obviously. Then they do a really good one with the ball in the third and defend. They were chasing less than 200 India and England defended it, Archer and Stokes. Then it's the draw, rain-affected draw again. And England are now chasing 375 in the last test.
Which, by the way, is a Baz ball-coded chase. They have chased 370-odd many a times. And that, you know, sort of target, you almost expect England to put up a very, very solid fight, if not win the test match. But, well, Siraj's brilliance won India that test. It was a really enjoyable series. And then it was just all about the Ashes, 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 Ashes. They turned up, had a great first day, mind you, right, at Perth. And it kind of all goes downhill from there. And I don't think any of those guys mentally recovered, you know, from that Ashes series. And it is worth mentioning that a lot of the culture around this team during the Baz ball era was about golf, you know, vacations mid-tournament or mid-series. Then you had your cigars and whiskies for all the times that Zach Crawley doesn't perform well with the bat. There were plenty of those issues and, nights out gone wrong. I mean, we couldn't even count those on our fingers at this point. So how much do you think all of the off-field nonsense contributed towards the fall of Baz ball? Because it is officially dead. You can't have Baz ball without Baz, and yeah. Baz has been sacked.
Yeah. So you said mentally, were they capable? No. But it's because their history of all these series that they said were preparing for the Ashes, we spoke about how there were two series that they drew that they should have won, but they pissed them away. Mm. That India chasing 370-odd in the fifth test they kind of had India where they wanted them.
Yeah.
They were 300 for three, Bayram, in that chasing 370-something. And they're 300 for three.
This is a
with
team.
With Harry Brooks.
This is a team which, once they used to get those 370-odd targets, would say, ah, should have been 450.
Yeah, but they were absolutely pissing up, and that's beating India at home 3-1 if they managed to not lose 70 for 7. And they totally mucked it up. You know, stupid shots. Bethell played one of the worst shots I've ever seen in his innings. And so we then, instead of going to Australia on the back of a 3-1 win against India, proper victory that, we're going on the back of another 2-2 where we should have won, right? Another one. So that's three series in the Bazball era, which isn't a very long era, that we have drawn when we should have won. That's India at home, Australia at home, and New Zealand away.
Yep.
Right? Could have had three wins in series. Instead, we got three draws.
But, Rob...
So then they bugger off to Australia.
Let's not forget how England actually played a role in inspiring India and Yashasvi Jaiswal, right? That's a bit that I completely forgot about. I mean, I'm not saying that Bazball did not have an impact on other teams. Of course it did. I even think Bazball is an important chapter in the history of Test cricket. But to just go off on that same self-praise train, it just got too much, man. I mean, I feel like at one point we were just contemplating how someone needs to go and tell these players what not to say in front of the media. I'm pretty sure Rob Key at some point even, you know, echoed that sentiment. But Rob Key created the monster himself. And then Rob Key in the Ashes was saying that, oh, I didn't know there was a drinking problem. If you're going out and having like a glass of wine with your food, that's fine. But you can't be completely, you know, getting hammered and shit. How did you not know? You guys are scheduling vacations in Noosa and Abu Dhabi in the middle of test series, important test series in India and Australia, right? So, I mean, it also felt like there was a lot of deceit at play when it comes to, you know, fooling the public.
Yes, yeah, so that's another thing. They lie to the paying public, the extremely high price paying public, constantly lie to them, and then even lie when they get caught. You know, the whole Harry Brook affair. You know, he came out and actively lied about what had happened when he got, you know, smashed by a bouncer for being a dick. They then come out and more, basically. The ECB told us their version of what happened, hoping to hell that no one would tell us the truth. And then the truth comes out, and then they have to go, well, actually, that did happen. Yeah, hands up. Yeah, we probably should have. And everything gets, you know, there's rumours that plenty of other things happened that we weren't told about. You know, stuff that I've been told, which I'm not supposed to say publicly, about certain individuals in the England team. It wasn't just the incidents we heard about, right? They damn well swept quite a few others under the carpet. So they've got a history of being idiots and being allowed to be, and almost actually, not just allowed to be idiots, because they are grown men and you can decide, you know, I want to do my best for my country or for my own career. Therefore, I won't go out drinking and I'll try and play cricket instead or get myself in a decent condition. But they're being encouraged by their bosses to muck about. I've worked in places where our bosses encouraged us to muck about and it was incredibly fun. But we would have been more productive had we not been encouraged to muck about by our bosses. Anyway, we've picked that Australia series apart several times.
Yep.
Us two.
I think we should probably have our own playlist on YouTube where we've just talked about England's you know, test team and Bazball in general. I think it would be a good like season for people to binge through at some point of their lives.
But it was an entirely predictable massacre. And the stone cold hard fact is England lost a series that was their best chance of winning since the last time we won over there, which was 15 years ago. Our best chance of winning there in 11 stupid, error-strewn days of cricket. And yes, England started off and you're like, oh, wow, we bowled them out cheap, lovely jubbly. Then the wheels didn't just fall off. You know, we're miles ahead of the game at lunch on the second day. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the second day, we've lost the test match.
Yep.
Like this is impossible. And we won a low scorer and got absolutely murdered in the other ones. And in at least two of those, England are in positions where they should be winning the game. Now, this was, as you said, an England side that decided that their best chance of winning the Ashes was by sacking their best ever bowler, right? So that was tactically very good, and replacing him.
And of course, let's not forget the trip to Noosa, because that was also very, very important in the middle of that series.
It's incredible.
But just on that series, like the away Ashes, England just couldn't understand what type of bowler they needed, because England is a haven, or is supposed to be a haven, for the not so quick line and length seamer who can get the ball to wobble, nip off the deck in either direction. Jimmy Anderson is the poster boy of that kind of seamer. And not only did they get rid of him, they just chose not to have any of those guys around. England was short and wide and spammed the bouncer non-stop versus Australia, and they got absolutely hammered. So this is where the tactics also completely fall off for Bazball, and that's what kind of maybe made those relationships untenable as well, between Stokesy, Baz, Key. I don't even know on what sort of terms they are currently, but it really seemed like, you know, those relationships got extremely fraught. And I'm not here to say that there were no good things about Bazball. I often make the case that there's a lot that they gave to cricket apart from the aggressive batting. Now, they should have probably been a bit more calculated with their aggression. They weren't. They were reckless. That's a separate topic altogether, which we've probably discussed as well. But, you know, we saw some funky field settings. The Usman Khawaja umbrella field comes to mind. And Stokesy, he had made a habit of, you know, tinkering with the field and manufacturing wickets when it seemed like, you know, a wicket wasn't coming. Then, of course, a lot of those batters started batting out of their crease en masse in the English team. And that was new. The bouncer ploy was adopted from Neil Wagner, and that's a Baz McCullum thing anyway. But then they took it, you know, to a length where they shouldn't have, or to an extent where they shouldn't have. The declarations started off well. They got weird later on. And even the field settings. I mean, Stokes was a constant tinkerer. Sometimes you just need to let things be. And the batting outside crease thing was killed off by keepers coming up to the stumps to keep. And that's kind of what England has suffered from in the last two series. Like Neeser, Boland, Zach Folks, Matt Henry, Nathan Smith, you name it. Right. So every ploy that they did come up with, they just kind of just stayed there. They never thought that maybe we need to, you know, kind of amp this up, or, you know, not amp this up, but think outside the box again, tweak this slightly and make it work for us. No, you've come up with a radical move and now we're just going to spam the radical move. And that's something that I personally did not appreciate, because I still believe that Bazball is important. And I thought as a tactic it worked, but they, or the English team, just thought that, you know, doing more and more of the same thing will eventually work. Whereas, you know, in professional sport, you have to constantly tweak and constantly upskill and constantly outthink your opposition. But outthinking the opposition is not something we associated with this, you know, partnership of Stokes and McCullum.
No, because they're stupid. But what happened was is that the Australian team were there for the taking because they didn't have Cummins for all but one test. They didn't have Nathan Lyon, huge key to the success of their attack.
Josh Hazlewood.
And they didn't have Hazlewood, right? That is massive. And their batting was in disarray. They didn't know what to do with Khawaja. He was batting all the way up and down the order, having been dropped and all this sort of nonsense. So the batting's in disarray, and they don't have any of their bowlers other than Stark, who bossed it. And then they went, all right, keep her up then, because we got Boland and Neeser. England got murdered. And this whole, we've been building up this whole Bazball revolution to beat Australia in Australia. And Captain Marvel, Ben Stokes, comes out shaking his head with an average of 18 at a strike rate of 36 with the bat in that series. Strike rate of 36. So, and what they did that infuriated me more than anything else, I think, in that series, was they didn't stay true to the whole Bazball thing. When they should have whacked, they didn't. And when they shouldn't have whacked, they did. They got it completely wrong. So that is stupidity.
Also,
and stupidity is something that's very difficult to get out of people.
I just remembered something, and now I'm going to purposely, very, very consciously trigger you. They did not have a fielding coach either. And a big part of that Ashes series was England dropping catches for fun. Proper butterfingers. It's like, you know, they had like some sort of rash on their hands that got worse when they would try to catch a ball. It was bad. And now they do have Sarah Taylor and whatnot, but they didn't have a fielding coach for quite a while. And then I remember Tim Southey, the bowling assistant coach or whatever, he left mid-Ashes to play in some T20 competition. I want to say the IL T20. It was a complete shambles. And you cannot possibly get all of these things wrong during a series, which according to you is the most important series and the only series you care about.
Yeah, it's a full joke. And whilst all this is going on, the meticulous planning of the piss-up holiday in the middle of it is so disgraceful that they've managed to organise that, and then they're going, well, we're not really drinking, whilst they're sat outside in public. You absolutely don't need to do that unless you're being a dick on purpose, right? So that if you want to get pissed, if you're a famous person, which the England touring cricket team are in Australia while they're over there, or if you're someone in the public eye, which England are when they're touring Australia, you can get absolutely leathered. You can do whatever you want because there's loads of places that you can just take over and have for yourself. The behind closed doors with no cameras, hotel bars, resorts, golf clubs, anything you want. And England are sat outside in the street where people have got camera phones, getting smashed round after round of beers next to a casino where they're staying. And Cass, who's not been in the side that long, he's played a handful of test matches, is running around after $100 bills in the street because they've fallen out of his pocket. This is a team that's getting stuffed in the series, if you don't mind. It's fine if you're 3-0 up. Piss about all you want because that rubs it in your opponent's faces. We're not even taking this seriously. Mm. But when you're getting murdered yourselves and you're carrying on like idiots, the joke is on you. And what England tried to do, which I will not forgive them for, is they tried to then defer all this onto their public, treat their public like they're really stupid, their fans, and go, well, listen, lads, actually, we never said it was the most important thing. Yes, you did. And you said it explicitly. And McCullum said it was the biggest series of our lives, is the quote. Yeah. And then when they get stuffed, McCullum himself, not brave enough to go to the media, actually, I said it was the biggest series ever, and we played like it was a pub game. He sent Jeet and Patel out to go, we never said it was an important series. Yeah. It was just another series and we lost to Australia and they're a good team. Never mind, on to the next
one. So basically,
absolute fiasco.
You can break this entire tenure of Bazball down in three sort of emotions. The first one is, it's all about entertainment and saving Test cricket. Then you go to the second phase where it's all about the Ashes. And then the third is that it wasn't all about the Ashes. And my biggest disappointment is that I'm a fan of the way England kind of attacked, right? I feel like in certain phases, that really works. You can really put the pressure on. And, you know, I mean, it forces results as well. Who likes draws anymore? No one. So my biggest disappointment is that we kept waiting for Bazball 3.0, Bazball with brains. I was sold on occasion that that might actually become a thing. But we never got to see it, right? And I think that's my biggest disappointment with this entire system.
The other thing that runs alongside all of this is the gaslighting bit, and I've said this several times, the greatest trick the devil pulled was convincing the world that he didn't exist. And the greatest trick that McCullum and Key pulled was convincing their bosses that results don't matter. Because it's the only sports team I can ever remember. Unless you're absolute crap, right? If you're what was that team that never won a football match for years and years? American Samoa or someone. Do what the hell you want. Go out and entertain people because you're losing 10-0 every week anyway. Mm. But if you're England, bear in mind, given the resource allocation in cricket, which is utterly unfair, England should be finishing second in most of these tournaments, right? Because England get overwhelmingly the second most amount of money. India get like half of it. England get a quarter of it. And the rest pick up the rest between them is basically how cricket is structured. So England should be finishing second if all things are right. And they finished fourth and fifth in the World Test Championship while McCullum was in charge with Key as his boss. And they went around going, we're saving cricket, everyone. No, you're not. You're finishing fifth when you're getting the second most amount of money, boatloads of tests at home in your own conditions, multiple tests at Lord's on a joke pitch because everyone pays, you know, 200 quid to sit down and sip their overpriced champagne. It's an utter joke. And then to come out and go, but we're saving Test cricket while we're doing it, aren't we? Mm. Well, the fans are going, we just watched you piss away another Test match series, another one and another one. And eventually, and you get to the end of that Ashes, right? And we picked it apart in real time as it was happening. I told everyone what was going to happen before the Ashes started. And as it was happening, we're like, well, we saw that coming a mile off what's happening now because they didn't prepare. The only thing they prepared was the piss up. They didn't prepare for any cricket at all. Then that materialized, and then they don't sack anyone. They had a review and they reviewed themselves and they all decided everything's fine. And there's a thing in gambling where you say system is going really, really well, please send more money, which means you've got a system, it isn't working, please continue to back me, I want to carry on gambling. And that's basically what they said. They all came out and they went, Rob, how do you think you're getting on? Pretty good. Brendan, I'll review you. I think you're doing really well. Boss, Richard, how are we doing? Yeah, fine. If you keep your jobs, I'll keep mine. What time's tea off tomorrow? Yeah. And that's basically the review process.
Also, there's a curfew that's put into place after that, which isn't respected after the first test versus New Zealand, which is the last test where Bazball was triumphant. No respect for that curfew either. Made a bit of a laughing stock out of themselves and the ECB. And this is a really fun super chat over here by Abhilash, who says, Bairam cults always die like this, hashtag not surprised. I remember the first time that Bazball was likened to a cult was, it was a piece on The Guardian written by Barney Roney. And it was literally, I think the title was The Cult of Bazball. Once you see it, you cannot unsee it. And they kept doubling, tripling, quadrupling down on the same sort of nonsense. And unfortunately, you know, I counted a few good things about Bazball as well. Like, aggressive batting at times was great. Forcing results, great. Funky field settings, I was a fan. I was also a fan of the Bazball shuffle where they bat outside their crease. And some of the declarations, at least the Rawalpindi one, was great. But it all kind of gets lost in, you know, the shadow of all of this dogmatic cultish nonsense. And I agree, cults do die like this because eventually the public catches on to that sort of bullshit. And I think, Rob, in that Ashes series, that's kind of where they couldn't fool the public any longer.
Yeah, and the thing is, they tried to, though, Bairam. They came out of it and they went, well, it couldn't have really gone any worse. I mean, England did win a test match, but it couldn't have really gone any worse considering Australia had, you know, a batting that was nonsense and only one fit bowler that they would have picked, right? And so England get murdered by that team. And then the only thing that they could have done after that is rip everything up and go, look, we buggered it up. Sorry, everybody. We're going to start again and we're going to get some sensible people or at least one sensible person in with these complete idiots and try and sort the cricket out of it. And instead, they reviewed themselves and said everyone's fine. And I watched the Nick Knight interview of Gould. Again, the timing of the announcements that this lot make is pretty disgusting as well. The Ben Stokes thing, which we picked apart at the time, was vile. The, you know, let's announce it now while he's in the middle of a big long spell. He had like five or six different standing ovations that day. Whilst England were pissing away a series, you know, that is not what I want to see. I wouldn't have been standing there applauding if I was there while he was deliberately taking all the team down with him and losing a series on purpose.
Isn't that what
I'd have been
cults
booing
do,
and
though?
Throwing things at him?
Cults convince you that you need to go down with the cult leader?
Yeah, I mean, and to the fans that are paying £8 a pint, watching this and are leathered by the end of the day when Stokes is doing this, the announcement's being made, and it's very easy, you know, and good on them if they want to turn around and shout, sack the board and we love Stokes and all this sort of utter nonsense. But then you see Stokes is gone for whatever reason. McCullum's head then becomes on the block. How can he survive and all this? And so the guy that's made that decision to bin him, presumably, is Richard Gould, right, the boss man. And then they decide they're going to interview him during the first ever England women's test at Lord's, right? That's pretty disgusting because that should be getting its own place in cricket, let alone English cricket, its own place in cricket culture. You know, there's people going on the honours board for the first time. India doing a great job of dismantling England. Some legends of the game of women's cricket retiring mid-test. There's plenty to talk about in that. Also, which I must talk about, one of the best catches I've ever seen in my whole life, that Gosh catch, is so good. Go and watch that for an hour before you go to bed tonight. It's absolutely incredible. But instead, you've got this guy who's refused to talk at any point publicly whilst the show that he was running was on fire because he'd poured the petrol on and ran away. He refused to front up at that point. He let everyone else answer the questions. He's then being asked questions by an incredibly cowardly lion, a timid yes man, who he probably said tonight, you can have the 10 minutes, you're having them exactly here, because as soon as Tammy Beaumont walks down those stairs, you'll have to cut anyway. You can have it right now, I'm going to sit in this nice comfy seat, you're going to sit there, here's the questions you're going to ask me, and if I answer them, don't you dare ask me them again. So Nick Knight sat there and just lobbed up these softballs. And Gould went, I don't really like that question. What I'll do is I'll just answer a different one. And he sat there and he at one point he spoke about Rob Key, right? And I've written down what he said. He's got a really good brain, is what he said about Rob Key. No evidence of that. He's a good communicator.
Hmm.
No, he's not. He has got an extraordinary knowledge of what goes on within our game in England. And he has spent the last 4 years in one of the most difficult jobs in English sports, one of the best jobs in English sports. Yep. And the amount of experience that not just he's amassed, but others within the team is really valuable for us. That is just bollocks. Every word of that is absolute horseshit. So, and then Knight basically said, did Rob Key have anything to do with the decision of McCollum going, right? Because they're mates, aren't they? They play golf together.
Yep.
He just sidestepped the question, didn't answer it. Then he basically said, what about your job? You know, and this is what Gould said. I consider my position on a daily regular basis because jobs are a privilege and you always want to make sure that you're trying to drive the team in the right direction possible. These jobs are quite complicated because unlike the FA, he's basically saying it's easy being the England football manager. Mm-hmm. It's got the England teams, it's got domestic teams, it's got grassroots cricket. And then he says, and I think I would look at my performance in the round if I was going to be generous, meaning he's doing a wonderful job for all of cricket. It's just that the players on the pitch are letting him down. But I also know that we need high-performing teams on the pitch. And he sat there with a big grin. He seemed like a perfectly affable chap, nice guy, good talker, obviously a very bright man. But he just sat there and went, I have just eaten Nick Knight alive here. I can say whatever I want, and off I go for a PIMS, and I'll see you lads next time I fancy putting my head above of the water. By the way, McCollum's gone. Go and talk to him now. Mm. And at least Brendan McCollum had the good grace to say the word sorry.
Yeah.
Right? At least he said that today. And whatever you think about the cricket and the decisions and all that, McCollum as a cricketer was awesome and did loads of awesome stuff. And he led New Zealand, you know, with Williamson some of the time, fantastically well. And he changed cricket a fair bit by himself. Mm. And he has brought a tactic to the England setup that is really good. But I thought his interviews were disgraceful while he had the job. But at least he used the actual word sorry and basically said the results were shit. Sorry about that. Mm. He did try and caveat it by saying, yeah, we tried this, we tried that. We've made cricket wonderful and all this stuff. But until somebody is accountable for this nonsense. So what they've done now is Stokes has gone. A lot of that is down to Stokes himself. McCollum's gone. But their bosses are still sat there slapping each other on the back saying what a wonderful job they're doing. What happens next? Now what happens, Beira?
I mean, there are still some things to talk about, of course, and these are fantastic points that you raise, Rob. But before that, or before going there, we shall be taking a short break. You guys are watching Combox Live with Rob Barron and Bairam. Go nowhere. We will be back in 16 seconds.
Ross Taylor couldn't see at night or when the clouds were in. Eventually, he had to see an eye specialist who would fix his eyesight. In the 2 years before the change, he still averaged more than 50 in international cricket. The top level of batting talent can basically see in the dark. That is who we are talking about in our new book, The Art of Batting. Head over and order your copy today.
Welcome back to Combox Live. You guys are with Bairam and Rob Barron, and we are currently breaking down Bazball. We had it for 4 years. We enjoyed it. You know, radical moves, some of them brilliant, some of them not so much at all. And ultimately, entertaining nonetheless. That is the takeaway. That would be, you know, Stokesy's quote would be on Bazball's tombstone. Whoever was lucky enough to watch us play yada, 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 that definitely deserves to be on the tombstone. But I actually found it quite fascinating that Baz McCollum apologized, you know, in that presser. He said sorry. And, you know, he was taking ownership about the fact that, you know, England did not beat India or Australia in a test series during his tenure. They drew against both at home and lost away quite miserably at that. And they also lost a home series to New Zealand, you know, at the very end of it all. And that is kind of ironic because it starts with beating New Zealand 3-0 at home. But there is an admission of not being good enough at the job and failing the public. That's a start. Are we going to get that sort of admission from the rest? I mean, like you said, Richard Gould, he sets up an interview with Nick Knight and sidesteps questions and, you know, says whatever he wants to say in those 10 minutes. And I think we've both established that if English cricket is the lock, then Rob isn't the key, right?
Yeah, well put. Yeah. I think... We have to now think what happens next. So the two people that are in charge are going to remain in charge, and they both think that that's a great idea. You know, I also think if I was in charge and failing spectacularly at a job that I was paid absolutely shitloads of money for, I would also think it would be a good idea if they kept me in that job. Mm. Whereas realistically, you know, if you've got a brain in your head, which I'm pretty confident that they do, if you're wildly underperforming, and they keep saying, well, it's the results that matter. All right, the results are terrible.
Yeah.
So either do something about them or get somebody in charge that can do something about them. And your job when you're in charge is to make the team. You can't dictate whether the team win or lose because sport's sport. But what you're meant to do is increase your team's chances of winning whatever competitions that you're in. And that involves planning, and at high level sport, it involves putting the right people in the right jobs. And a lot of what you need to do that is money. And as I've already discussed, England get the second most amount of money in world cricket because cricket isn't fair. Life isn't fair either.
Yep.
But cricket isn't fair. So England get the second most amount of money and they use that to finish fifth, which is unacceptable. And then they come out and say, we don't care about it. It's such an easy fix for the next person in charge. It will probably be a man, let's be honest. And to just go in and go, right, what we are going to do is take all these tournaments seriously. We're going to try and win them all. That breath of fresh air is a very easy one to implement and go, listen, lads, if anyone loses us a test match's worth of points because they can't bowl their overs quickly enough, we're going to drop you because we'll just get somebody in that can't. Because basically, they could have had me and you playing in the second test against New Zealand and just bowling the overs quicker. And they would have performed better. They would have achieved, you know, rolling through our overs as quickly as possible and getting hit for 36 every over would have been better for the World Test Championship than what England actually did.
I mean,
do you know what I mean?
I think
that's madness, isn't it?
I think you would have got better than England in the second test. I can definitely vouch for
that. There's no question about that.
For those of you who have missed that video, go to our archives on Combox YouTube channel and find Rob's video where Rob Uthappa, tosses 30 catches Rob's way, and I'm not going to tell you how many he catches, but it's a really, really fun video. Also, I have completely missed the super chat, which we should probably bring up by Sankalp. He says, hi Rob, do you think Bazball could have been Oakland A/Moneyball moment, but wasn't because of Baz Stokes and ECB stupidity, or are we not there in cricket yet? So before Rob answers this, we are there in T20 cricket, mind you. There's a lot of science to that sport now, and teams a kind of set their composition and pick certain players accordingly. And they do look at outputs in certain phases. And I feel like cricket has already been in its Moneyball era. And I actually, I'd like to believe that at least Stokes McCullum and even Key, they thought that they were doing that. You know, there were some really funky selections. I mean, Shoaib Bashir has played 20-odd test matches just because he has a high release point for a spinner. Tom Hartley was picked for the same reason, never saw him again. Jamie Smith, loved Jamie Smith the batter, but he only made the squad because he could bat and could also keep wicket, not a frontline wicketkeeper. And, you know, there are plenty of other similar picks. I mean, Sonny Baker was a recent one, and all of those different kinds of fast bowlers who could hit the deck hard and be good on flat decks, but maybe that wasn't the task at hand, and in England misunderstood their homework. I think they actually did try to be out of the box and funky with their selection, and they used Crickviz and all of those things. But it wasn't really Moneyball. I think they were at times forcefully trying to think outside the box.
Yeah, well, there's the thing with Moneyball, and Moneyball's a wonderful book, a really, really good film. It's one of those ones where you can just take the easy option and watch the film and you'll still get kind of what it all means from the film. Great film, go and watch it. The thing with them is they are trying to compete on a field that isn't level, so they have very little money compared to a lot of the big franchises, you know, the Yankees and all that. They can't compete with them, the Oakland A's, so they have to do something that is cleverer. And if you go to take it to Premier League football, go and watch what Brentford and Brighton have done, who are run by two of the best gamblers that have ever lived in England. They are absolutely bossing it with sparse resources because they moneyballed the hell out of it. Now, this was identifying players that were undervalued by other people. A style of football was introduced, and then they picked the players to fit the style. So that's like super fast guys at fullback or incredibly strong guys in the middle that win tackles or whatever style they want to play. I'm no expert on football, that's for sure. But what the Oakland A's did is they went, well, this guy, yes, on paper, he's shit at catching and he can't run and he's getting old. But the fact is he gets on base this much and so therefore he's worth this much to us. I think they should do a lot more of this in cricket. But the crucial difference here, Bayram, is England are very much like the Oakland A's, not competing on a level playing field with the other teams, but it's stacked in England's favour. The Oakland A's have got to sit there and go, well, we have to do all this thinking and work out the money ball, which is genius. All of it's genius. Everybody does it now. So like any good thing, it just gets copied by everyone. And then the richer teams will copy it better and all that. England have the second most amount of money. So they don't have to think about this. They should concentrate more on their grassroots stuff. They should pick the best 11 players to win the test match that they're trying to win today.
They should,
right, the one they're playing today.
They should essentially pick someone else to open the bowling other than Brydon Carr.
Right. So what they end up with is selections that are mental, are completely mental, and they justify them by saying we're being really clever. And it's like, why am I watching Sonny Baker play in a test match? Why am I watching that? Because he has no numbers that suggest he could be any good at it. Similar to why did I see him in a T20 and why did I see him in an ODI? Mental. Why did I watch Josh Hull play in a test match that we lost? Why did that happen? Because he's got no numbers. He was averaging 200 or something in the county championship. And you're watching people get picked. Well, there's a guy who's averaging half what they're averaging at half the economy rate who they've decided they don't want to play. And yeah, well, that doesn't make any sense. So you're saying it's Moneyball. It's not, because what Moneyball is really clever. It's using metrics and data to make selections that give you a better chance of winning. What England are doing is they're saying we've got data right, and there is a metric that the England cricket team use, I've been told, and I would love to see it. I'm desperate to get my hands on it. But basically, they're saying if you're tall, you're a way, way, way better chance of being in our bowling attack than if you're not. If you use your left arm, you're a way, way better chance than if you don't. And then they end up with Bashir, who I think, as an individual, has performed superbly well given his talent and his starting point. He has not let anybody down in his England career. I think he's been treated like dirt and he's performed excellent compared to what could have happened with Bashir, because he could have got absolutely massacred in his first spell. His first spell, he actually did. He got whacked more than people that got dropped and were never seen again, the likes of Kerrigan and I can't remember the others off the top of my head, but people like him who played Borthwick, people that played like one session for England, got whacked and never got seen again. Bashir could have been another one of those. He was world captain, did all that. But the fact of the matter is, Bayram, is they picked probably 6, 7, 8 players that should never have got anywhere near the England Test team, because of stupid made-up metrics. Now, that's not Moneyball. That's stupid people thinking they're being clever by picking people that don't deserve to be in the team. And you watch, it happens also, like everyone can have their opinion. The discourse around the England football team at the moment is, well, why the hell didn't they pick the Real Madrid right back in the squad? How does he not get in the first 26 names or whatever? And then you're watching people playing out of position in must-win World Cup matches, right? It happens all across sport. People have their opinions and whatever. But England's are proven to be rubbish. And when you have all the money, or the second most amount of money, then what are you doing picking random left field selections that help you finish fifth?
Yeah.
Because you should be put what teams like West Indies and Sri Lanka that have very confused pathways because of board madness and unfair playing fields. They're not on even playing fields. They have less money. The boards are quite often in disarray. I mean, look at the Pakistan board, for God's sake. Babar's back in charge now, isn't he?
Yep.
It's all madness everywhere. And what Sri Lanka try and do sometimes is they go, right, we're going to give you this bowler you've never seen before in a World Cup. They'll turn up to a World Cup. Dhananjaya was one of the spinners. We don't know who this guy is, and he's playing in the first World Cup game. Good luck. And they'll, or this guy's got a really slingy action, or this guy bowls off the wrong foot or whatever. They have to mix it up to try and give them, that's thinking outside the box. All England have to do, they've got all the money, think inside the box. England would have won loads more of these series that we've just picked apart if they would have thought inside the box, but they decided they were going to go outside the box and just shoot themselves in the head as often as they possibly could.
Also, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding of Moneyball is that you're not only looking at physical attributes, you're actually looking at some numbers and where or how those players can be effective. Whereas I think what England did was just look at a certain profile of player. They're not concerned with how well that player has done, because, you know, with all, you know, due respect to Shoaib Bashir, I actually don't think he's that bad, but he wasn't even Somerset's starting spinner, right? They were looking for a prototype of player, and that's it. They're not actually looking at the numbers, whether or not they kind of fall in line with the physical attributes that they're looking at. So I feel like, yes, they shot themselves in the foot many a times, and it might be anti-Moneyball because they make it look like they're doing something clever involving quick viz and all, but it really isn't all that clever. And I mean, Sonny Baker shouldn't be playing a test match, especially, you know, I mean, Jimmy Anderson shouldn't be retired from a format in which he's still, you know, featuring at domestic level and doing very well at that. So there are a lot of those selection calls that were, honestly, they actually did deserve their own segment in this show. But there is a repeated trend in this entire baseball tenure of England just repeatedly shooting themselves in the foot, whether that be tactically, selection-wise, in-game decision-making, off-field nonsense, you name it, they've done it, right? And yeah, I mean, it does feel kind of sad or bittersweet that it has ended, at least from my perspective, because, you know, say what you will, it was highly entertaining to cover. I did not miss a single test match that they played, and there's a reason for that. And now my question is, just to end this show, Rob, there is, you know, there are murmurs in the media that, you know, they've contacted Andy Flower. There's a piece on Cricket Info which mentions that England are fine with their new red ball head coach to coach in the IPL as well. That's basically them saying, Andy, if you want this job, you have it. But we don't know what Andy Flower will say in response. He might just not want this job at all because he's got some scars from the past. If not Flower, it could be Trott. It could be Freddie, because Rob Keed, for one, loves Freddie. It could be anyone. Gosh. It could be Ravi Shastri, for all we know, right? Do you think that they will continue to play the same way, or will they be a bit more tempered with their approach and maybe, you know, finally we'll get to see some brains with respect to taking the attack to the opposition? What do you think the future holds? Who are your front runners for the job? I know you want Owen Morgan to replace Rob Key, but let's not go to places which we know will never, you know, be seen. But yeah, who's your pick for head coach? Who do you think they will hire? And how is this team going to play? What brand of cricket will we get to see when England take on Pakistan at home next month?
So the regime that has just died spent almost the entire time listening to the media and trying to antagonize them. I don't include myself in that. They antagonized me long before anyone ever asked me to talk publicly. I mean that, you know, the big media, the mainstream media, Sky and all that, whenever they made suggestions that were rational, England did the opposite, and they came out and they, you know, we're not going to do that. We're not going to listen to you. We know best. And it proved beyond all possible argument that they didn't know best. You know, it was utter madness what they were doing, and it went as expected, right? They did stupid stuff. They got bad results. So what happens next is your question. The front runner for the job, because now they have to kind of listen to all these people, these ex-players, these clever people about cricket. They have to listen to them a bit because they didn't listen and it went tit. And now they need to listen to them. So when you've got them all shouting, pay him whatever he wants, let's get Andy Flower in charge. Mm. I mean, I don't know what happens to McCullum's money. He's got another year on his contract. I bet he got a few quid for leaving his job. So they've done a million on him. How much are they going to do on Flower if Flower... Because Flower now is in a position where he can absolutely dictate whatever terms he wants. So he's going to say, look, I'm keeping my RCB gig and I ain't working for you between this month and this month of the year. And that IPL window is only going to get bigger,
yeah,
right? Spoiler alert. It's only going to get bigger. The auctions will last longer. There'll be more of them. There'll be more time before and after that they want to take off. And traditionally, England are playing test match right up to the IPL and one straight away after. And he won't be there. So that will... If England want Flower, they get 70% of Flower on 250% of whatever wages he was on last time,
yeah,
if that's what they want. And it doesn't usually work when you go back to somebody that was great before, because cricket has changed a lot. I'm not saying he's a bad coach, because clearly he's incredible and he would be a good guy to have. Personally, I don't want someone that wants 4 months a year where his focus is somewhere else. And if you're a good coach for RCB, you're working the whole year, right? They've won it back-to-back for a reason. They use good data. They use it in a smart way. And he is at the forefront of making the good decisions.
Yeah.
He's not going to have a blind eye to the IPL for the other 9 months of the year, is he?
No,
of course,
I mean,
he isn't.
He's probably constantly thinking about that three-peat, right? He wants to build his own legacy at RCB. And look, I do believe that the best cricket head coach in contemporary cricket, right, is Andy Flower. But bear in mind, Andy Flower hasn't coached a test team in a bit. Test cricket is different. His commitments will kind of challenge him when he's in the role that, okay, today do I think about RCB or do I think about England? Now, they are desperate. They really, really want Andy Flower's signature, but it might not work out, you know, optimally as they imagine it to. And, you know, Flower might be offered a fuck ton of money, but Rob, he might just say no because he doesn't want to work as much. He might just want to work 4 months a year, right? Like, there are variables in this entire situation. Personally, I feel that it's 50-50. It could go either way. But if not Andy Flower, who would you pick?
So out of the ones that are being... I'm not allowed to pick who I want, am I? I have to pick from the names that are being touted, right? So yeah. I don't think it's just a coincidence that Fleming is no longer with Chennai as of this week. I don't think that's a coincidence. I'm not saying that that means they're definitely going to give him the England job or he really wants it. But it's a surprise because he's been with Chennai for bloody 20 years or whatever, hasn't he? Yeah. He's been with Chennai since day dot. So maybe Fleming gets into it. And I wouldn't mind that much. I think he would be a better test guy than he is a T20 guy. I think T20 is probably sped up a bit too fast for Fleming.
Yep.
I wouldn't mind Fleming being in charge. The other names about Flintoff, absolutely, definitely not. Like a huge no, because that just extends this nonsense with someone who's even less qualified to extend it, I'm afraid.
What about Jonathan Trott? I'm quite interested in Jonathan Trott. I think he had a very successful stint with Afghanistan, and he's someone who would understand Test cricket, right?
He looked good with Afghanistan. I think he was quite badly mismanaged when he dropped out of a tour, an important tour, when he basically said, I was really, really tired. And England, the ECB came out with such terrible mixed messages about, you know, he left for mental health reasons and he left for depression. And then it was like, no, he's not, he's tired and all that sort of stuff. So he's been mucked about by the ECB. I don't know how he feels about that. I think he's clearly a very test cricket oriented brain that he's got, which is a good thing. He's not going to be... even though, like, to be fair, he got Afghanistan to the T20 semi-final, right, on a dog of a pitch that they collapsed on. But that's a good effort. So he's got some credentials behind him. I don't know the guy personally, and I don't know whether he'd be good at it or not. But he is a name that if he was in charge, I would be like, all right, let's see what he can do. Let's get behind him. He's obviously pretty smart. Other names that are about Mickey Arthur, because he's always about for every job. He's good at coaching cricket teams. He's also coached everybody, which kind of helps. I don't want England to do.
Where is Gary Stead at?
Don't know.
Yeah, he's another option.
I don't think he'll be the next England coach. I mean, he's the least likely of all the ones we've said.
If they really want to, they could poach Mike Hessen as well.
So, that would be fine. Mike Hessen's obviously a very, very good coach. That would probably be a good one. But I think his brain, from everything I read from him, which I agree with him a lot more than I agree with most public speaking coaches, if you know what I mean, the ones that tell us what they're thinking. I think he's got a great brain, but he's very T20, isn't he? Mm. His thinking that he comes out and tells us is very smart for that format. I don't know. Maybe he'd be really good at that. I don't know if Jared's more qualified to say whether Gareth Batty should get the job, but it can't be Darren Layman, which is something that I read earlier.
What about
it better not be him.
The biggest joke would be if one of Shastri or JL take up this job.
Yeah, it would be really funny if it was Ravi Shastri. Mm. That would be really funny, and I would get all behind that because he's also pretty smart, Ravi Shastri. Mm. Say what you want about him, he's pretty smart, and he's been in charge of the India circus, so. It's not like he's going to be overwhelmed by the job, is it? Yeah. Anyone that's done that job. Like, I don't think that he would be a terrible appointment at all, and it would be funny. So I am behind that one. Langer would be the worst possible, I think. I would rather have Flintoff than Langer because I watched both series of the test, and I know people that know Langer, and that would be an awful fit. I read his, because I am and in some way masochistic, I read the utter bilge that he spouts on LinkedIn and stuff when he's going out and saying how we should all behave and what the key to the universe is.
Don't you think it would be beneficial if in that English dressing room, JL is telling all the players what it means to be Australian?
Well, indeed. No, it wouldn't. And the way he comes across and how he speaks, what does he call himself here? Leader stroke mentor, Justin Langer. Just please, no. and his comment, like, I just never agree with anything he says, pretty much. Some would be saying that's not a bad thing for English cricket, but please, 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 please not Langer for so many reasons. Shastri funniest, so let's go Shastri. The correct answer is obviously me. I would put people that I want around English cricket to make decisions are someone that fills in the Strauss role, that if somebody's being a knobhead, they get told. Somebody who is a good gambler, right? Because McCullum is a rubbish gambler. Sorry, Brendan, but you are. And there are people who could probably verify that with numbers. But the throwing away two test series by declaring at the wrong time is testament to McCullum being a bad gambler, and Stokes to a certain extent. Owen Morgan is a good gambler. He's well connected in the betting industry. I know people that know him very well. He is a smart cookie when it comes to gambling. So he understands odds. And if you understand odds percentages and cricket, as Owen Morgan massively does, it doesn't matter that he wasn't all that good at playing test cricket. Get the guy somewhere in charge where he can help them make these decisions, because he can help by making declarations and stuff like that, or tactics that make the team more likely to win. He's one of the best I've ever seen at that. So having Morgan around, good idea. Then you want someone that really knows cricket and can navigate around the carnage and the circus. I don't really know what Mark Nicholas has been up to, other than somewhat annoying commentary, but he's got really, really good cricket brain. If you read his books and listen to him talk about cricket, I don't see how he would be a bad guy to have around. They have lots of options. What they're going to do is they're going to publicly try and get Flower at all costs. My hunch is Flower says, nah, I'm all right. Like, I've seen what you've done with everyone else. That looks like a poison chalice. Also, you're inheriting a rubbish team. Maybe he's not that old, Flower. He's still like early 50s, I think. Maybe that's a good challenge for him. And he's done a couple of IPLs and he can still keep his IPL gig and get, I don't know how money focused that guy is. He's going to get absolute mega coin if he takes the job.
Yep.
Maybe he does. My hunch is he doesn't. And if he doesn't, I then become quite sure that England will make a really bad decision, because what they're doing now is doing what they always do, is they're all in on something that doesn't happen, and then they'll just panic. And it could be as mad as possible. It could be like Flintoffer and Langer. Do you know what I mean? They go, Langer's the senior guy because he's got the experience, and we want Freddie to do it because everyone loves Freddie. That would be absurd, right? They need some level of sense in the room. So the other names you spoke about, Hessen would be great. I think I'd like to see test-focused man in charge of tests. That's what I would like to see.
All right. Well, the way I see it is, whoever takes over the reins of England's red ball head coach, what I'd just like to see from this England test team, of course, they're not expected to win everything. They're not that high quality a team. But it's still possible to keep the good bits from Bazball and move forward. And maybe, you know, in like a decade or so, we can look back at this chapter, you know, with a smile on our faces that, okay, maybe that Bazball experiment went south, but we got to a stage via it that isn't all too bad. And that is the best case scenario that I see for England right now. But my worry is they might not even keep the best bits. They might go back to boring England.
I mean, that would be a really bad legacy, wouldn't it? As if they take over and England go back to, you know, they go, right, Joe, we know you don't want the job, but can you please be the captain? And I've only spoken about that. Who's going to be the captain? So if they go route, it will go back. And England don't have the players that they had when they were not fulfilling their potential because they were being too boring. So they'll become shit and boring. You know, I'd much rather they were shit and fun, you know. Unfortunately, because of Stokes, you know, disappearing whilst setting fire to the building on the way out, there's a rebuild that needs to happen in one way or another.
Yeah.
And they can look back or they can look forward. And whoever does it needs to be given time, and they need to think clearly, which is something that obviously hasn't happened for several years now. I don't know where they're going to go with it, but I hope, as I think you do, Bayram, that they notice that the aggressive bit of Bazball as a tactic is a great idea when used at the right time. And test match cricket always has and always will be a game where gears are essential. We play in different gears that have ever been used before. There's now a sixth gear that, you know, they added it to the automobile. They added it to cricket, which at some point is a great gear to be using. But if you can't use first gear and second gear when the clouds have come in or when that pink ball's hooping around, then you don't deserve to put yourself in a chance to win the match when the sun comes out and it's flat.
Yeah.
And England have proven time and time again that they can't use their brains to put the car in the right gear. So when they're in sixth gear, when they should be in second because they're going round a roundabout, the car starts spluttering and smoke comes out the back and it flips over. Yeah. That's what this whole Bazball thing has been, right? If you want a shitty analogy about cars, that's what's happened
also,
in the last 4 years.
It is worth mentioning that in recent times, England have only won test matches on lottery pitches, and that's kind of where Bazball does to a certain extent work. Like, if one of those deliveries has got your name written on it, you might as well have a crack at it. Although I will say that the New Zealand test win, the first test at Lord's, wasn't quite that, but the Ashes one, to a certain extent, was. But point is that they really need to be coy about this, and it doesn't take a lot of brain to figure out that there were some good bits of Bazball that we can retain, and we can build on top of that and just, you know, be a bit smart about the different phases of the game and the different demands of each phase. And as you mentioned, what gears need to be used in different phases. And similarly with the bowling, right? Like, what length should we be bowling on this surface? If we have planned to spam the bouncer, well, maybe this is one of those wickets where you actually need to target the stumps. These are the sort of intricacies that I would like to see England inculcate into their game. Whether we get that or not, we've got no clue. We have no idea how this might pan out for England. And I suppose the Pakistan series will be pretty lit, because it's two teams in absolute disarray, and what more can we possibly ask for? But anyway, I think we've been going on for an hour and 20 plus actually now, Rob. Time to call this one. It's been an absolute pleasure talking Bazball with you over the last couple of years. It's an absolute shame also that this has come to an end, but it was fun while it lasted. It was a great ride.
Agreed.
All right, then. Thank you to all of you as well in the comments section. Thank you for your interactions. Thank you for your super chats as well. They definitely do help us a lot. And also, just lastly, follow Combox everywhere. Like, share, and subscribe. We'll be back on your screens soon enough talking about something different. Different combinations of us will be talking about everything with respect to cricket. And we're about to amp it up as well. So lots and lots of content coming your way. But till then, just, you know, wait patiently, have fun, enjoy yourselves, and move on. All right. See you guys. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast on the Combox Network. There is an ad-free version of this you can find by supporting us on Patreon at Good Areas Podcast. You can also access our Discord channel there. Please like, subscribe, and rate this show. Every one of these helps us. If there was a guest on a show, you can find their links in the show notes. Huge thanks to Ruckshit, Ishit, and everyone else who helps us get our content out there. If you want to know more about us, head to combox.tv.
If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.